when I meet with someone or a family, I'm not just listening for the pathology, the presenting problem. I'm listening for the strength of like, what has allowed you to make it this far? And I saw this lovely interview with a Jewish woman who said, the ways that we have survived have not always been beautiful, but we survived. And I think that's the truth for many of us. Like, it didn't always look good. Right? It wasn't always neat. But this is how I made it. So being able to integrate or acknowledge those strategies is really important.
From the Mount Sinai Health System in New York City, this is Road to Resilience, a podcast about bouncing, walking, crawling, and leaning back from adversity. I'm John Earl. That phrase comes from our guest today, Dr. Tama Bryant-Davis. She's a polymath of the soul. Dr. Tama, as she's known, is a professor of psychology and director of the Culture and Trauma Research Lab at Pepperdine University. Her many books and academic articles include Thriving in the Wake of Trauma, a Multicultural Guide. Dr. Tama is also an ordained minister, as well as an accomplished slam poet and dancer. And lastly, she is the host of the Homecoming podcast with Dr. Tama. Like Dr. Tama's work, our conversation was wide-ranging, touching on psychology, faith, and art. About halfway through, my collaborator Nikki Cheatham takes over, and the topic turns to racial trauma and healing, a space Dr. Tama has worked in for many, many years. And so, this is a special episode, and we hope you enjoy it as much as we did. Dr. Tama, welcome to Road to Resilience.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here and glad for the conversation.
So, I've been working on this podcast for a couple of years now, and I still struggle to define resilience. Very early on, I moved away from the, I think, very common definition of resilience is overcoming adversity. It's too heroic. It's too rosy. It doesn't capture all the ways that people can be resilient. You described resilience so beautifully. You said it's bouncing, walking, crawling, leaning back from adversity. And yeah. I love that variety of ways of being resilient. And so my question is, why is it important to acknowledge right. all the faces
yes.
of resilience?
I love you for starting with that, because it is really critical for us to be compassionate with ourselves and compassionate with others, to know that we don't all come with the same makeup, the same personality, the same stress load, the same supports. And so the ways in which we respond to stress and trauma are going to be different. And if we only recognize resilience when it is shiny, we will miss it. And so even during the pandemic, you know, some people like took up a hobby, learned a language, learned a new instrument. And for some people, it was resilient to be able to get out of bed each day, to be able to bathe, to be able to give food to their children was an act of their resistance, because everything in them was telling them to stay under the covers. So it will cause us to overlook our own growth and progress if we miss that, or if we have kind of one cookie cutter picture of what it looks like. Even in this season of the Olympics, we have seen the announcement from Simone Biles that she's going to step away from the games for her mental health. We had Naomi Osaka stepping away to take care of her mental health. Those are acts of resilience. And many times we would just think it is the people who stay and the people who win a gold medal. But I think all of us can think about times when walking away from a job was an act of resilience, when walking away from an unhealthy relationship was an act of resilience. So I may not have a trophy to show for it, but I did a radical act for my wellness, for care, sometimes in service of other people. And we want to be able to see that.
This word radical, you use it to describe joy, to describe stillness, to describe making space for yourself, taking care of yourself. What's radical about these things?
We live in a culture, in a society where those things are not authentically promoted. So they are given lip service, but the environment is not created for that to happen. So, for example, I teach in a graduate school in a doctoral program, wonderful program. I love it. However, we talk to our students every semester about self-care and how important it is to take care of yourself. But then we hand them these class schedules and internship schedules that really are not conducive for self-care. And so for them to be intentional when there are all these pressures that tell you to erase yourself, to deny yourself, to ignore even your own bodily signals, right? Your body is saying you're tired. Your body is saying you're hungry. Your body is saying I need to get outside, right? And this structure, this system that we live in really promotes that our worth is in our busyness. So there's nothing radical about being busy. That's ordinary, right? That is the expectation. You know, we teach kids all the way from primary school, line up, aim for the A's, do what you're told, be quiet, right? There's nothing radical about being a quiet, busy bee, right? What is it that the family, the world, sometimes faith communities are teaching us makes us valuable? And so often to daydream is not what is promoted. You know, we don't say to young people, you know, what are you dreaming about or what is bringing you joy? You know, even when as adults we run into each other, we'll say, what's your latest project, right? What are you up to? Because we're naming what we value. And so, you know, what did you do to make yourself laugh or smile or exhale this weekend, right? That's radical.
Well, why don't I ask you that question?
I would love to answer. And one of the beautiful gifts of parenting is, you know, kids will want to play. So then it makes me play. So going swimming with my son, I took my son and daughter to play soccer in an open field with our mask on. We were out there playing soccer and my son was very frustrated with me. I'm not a great soccer player, so it was not giving him the competition he wanted. But we had a good time. I also try to get in my steps, so go walking. And I have not seen my parents who live on the East Coast since the pandemic. And so I was able to talk with them on yesterday. We do like a family call, actually a prayer call once a week. And that really nourishes me and helps me to feel like it hasn't been as long as it's been. So those are some of the things I enjoy.
A question for you about the podcast. It's called The Homecoming Podcast with Dr. Tama. You do these brilliant, typically about 30-minute monologues on things like fear of commitment, being open to feedback. But my question is about homecoming. Why this word homecoming, this theme that you return to again and again?
It's because so many times we think we need to become something other than who we are. You know, that's peer pressure and social comparison. It's like, if only I was like this sibling who's the favorite or this cousin who's the favorite, or if only I was like this model on the cover of a magazine or on this billboard or like one of these popular Instagram models who looks very attractive. Like if my aim is always out there, then I will always be second best because I am not the thing I am pursuing. And so it is liberating to discover that we are enough, that like the magic, the beauty is to stop chasing, to stop performing, that the authentic you is the truth, right? That's the good stuff. And it is remarkable, and it's also contagious. Because when you're in the presence of someone who's at home with themselves, it often gives you permission to take off your mask and to be more real. I mean, that's what intimacy is, right? Is, you know, this sharing, this openness versus the performance that many of us engage in. I give by way of example when we say, how are you? And the socially appropriate answer is fine, and you, and the other person says fine. Or in faith communities, how are you? I'm blessed. I'm better than blessed. In my community, we would say I'm blessed and highly favored, right? Really juicy. But there is something so freeing about being able to give a real answer, to know that people want to actually know the truth, not from like just a nosy surveillance place, but like human to human, right? Making that connection. And so homecoming is the reminder that you are already enough, that you are already quote unquote good, and that when you lay down the baggage and the performance, that's where the gift is.
All the tools and techniques that you talk about, do they all lead to that one place?
It's that the reason why we need an array of tools. One is we have different personalities. So some people like different things, right? Some people, if I mention poetry therapy, they're like, oh my God, I would love that. And then other people are like, I want to meditate or pray. Interestingly, a lot of my therapy sessions, I'll start with a brief meditation. And I have some clients who are like, oh my gosh, if I could just get that, I'm ready for the session to be done. Like, that's all they needed. It was like this few minutes of guided meditation. And then I have other people who will say, can I say a prayer instead? Or other people will say, I just want to start. I don't want to do that breathing thing. Which all of it is fine. There's not one path. It's discovering the path that brings you home.
Ever thought about enrolling in a clinical trial? The Mount Sinai Health System has over 800 active clinical trials, each geared toward developing new medicines and treatments. Visit mountsinai.org/clinical-trials to see if you're eligible. Mount Sinai, we find a way.
You are the daughter of two ministers. You are an ordained minister. When I've heard you talk about faith, you often talk about the things that many spiritual traditions have in common. Meditation, which we just talked about, is one of them. Is there something that you feel that your Christian tradition brings that's special to the conversation about resilience?
Yeah. So actually, I have a model that I received, however you want to think about it. It's the CRISTO psychology model of trauma recovery, CRISTO in Christ-centered, and looking at the crucifixion as a trauma. And I think we can all agree it was traumatic. I think sometimes, you know, with this Easter presentation, people are telling this horrific story, but like with smiles and joy, but it's like, this is a horror, right? So then it's interesting because there's nothing new under the sun, is when you look at the steps of what Jesus did after the crucifixion, a lot of what he did models or reflects what is recommended in terms of trauma recovery. So it is a great example of, you know, how do I come out of horrific situations, right? So the first one is what I call tomb time. And I like to say, because of who God is, at any moment, God could have gotten Jesus up. But I know in the church tradition, especially in the Black church tradition, we love like a good dramatic story. So often the way pastors will preach it is they'll say for 3 days, Jesus was fighting the devil and fighting death. And it was like a close call. And then he finally broke loose. But because who God is, you know, I just believe at any moment, God could have brought Jesus out of there. But it is a message to us to sometimes give ourselves permission to be still, especially in the aftermath of tragedy, that often we feel like as an act of our faith that we have to pretend nothing happened, that we have to jump right up. So taking tomb time is one. The second one is that he appeared to the women. And this issue of social support, of not everyone can handle your trauma and your blood. So you want to choose those who have shown you, they'll show up for you when you're hurting, when it's not pretty, when you're not being miraculous, when you're not being glossy and shiny, right? That's a certain kind of person. So choosing who can be with you when you are in the aftermath or in the midst of a trauma. So anyway, it goes on. There are like these seven steps.
I think this also ties into this idea that you've been exploring for a long time of cultural competence in trauma healing, the idea that we can tap into and we need to tap into our traditions and our context in order to heal. We can't simply rely on the playbook provided by people from different communities. Can you unpack that idea a little bit for us?
The field of psychology, of course, I believe is wonderful because I'm in it. And at the same time, a lot of times we need more professional humility. There can be an arrogance in assuming that there is one way to heal. And if you haven't done this one way that we have formulated or that we have packaged, then you haven't worked on yourself. And I hear, you know, people even in the public saying that, of like, if you have not done individual psychotherapy, which for many people is inaccessible, that somehow you are less thoughtful, right? And you know, I value therapy, I promote it, I encourage people who can access it to access it. And also, I'm very much aware that there are multiple strategies and pathways, and some of those, when it is culturally appropriate, and respectfully, we can even integrate into therapy. And one of the things that psychologists talk about, especially community psychologists or liberation psychologists, is the importance of a strengths-based approach, which means when I meet with someone or a family, I'm not just listening for the pathology, the presenting problem. I'm listening for the strength of like what has allowed you to make it this far? And I saw this lovely interview with a Jewish woman who said, the ways that we have survived have not always been beautiful, but we survived. And I think that's the truth for many of us. Like, it didn't always look good. It wasn't always neat. But this is how I made it. So being able to integrate or acknowledge those strategies is really important.
What's the tool that you reach for when life throws you a curveball?
So there's a couple. One is individual therapy, right? Is so helpful because I am among the people that, and some of you who are listening will be that one as well, where you are the quote unquote strong one, right? Or you are the one that usually pours, or you are the one who is in leadership. And, you know, we have seen in the news, many pastors, you know, who have struggled with depression, with suicide, and feeling like there was no one they could turn to. And so I never want to put myself in a position where I believe I have to figure it out all by myself. Right. Or I believe I have to have all the answers because sometimes we're too close. Right. If we're honest, it's always easier, usually easier to see something if you're looking at it outside of you. Right. If someone else is explaining to you an issue and you're not caught up in it, you just have more perspective. So therapy has been a wonderful resource for me. Another one for me that I've talked about a lot in the podcast is dancing and poetry, the arts. You know, the arts are a way of speaking the unspeakable. There are some things we don't have the full language for, or some things you don't want to fully say. And so we can code it in our art in a way. See, trauma survivors often have been denied their own power. But when I am creating art, I have power over my narrative. And so whether in dance or poetry or visual art or music, I can say as much or as little as I want to. And that can also be freeing. I will also say, as a trauma survivor, dance is one of the main reasons why I have always pretty much had a good relationship with my body, because my connection to my body is not just as a site of violation, right? It's a site of strength, a site of expression, a site of freedom. And so that's just one of the many experiences that I have had in this body. And so it can be a wonderful way of reclaiming yourself. So art, therapy, and then, of course, I will, you know, say my faith, that, you know, how do you have hope or faith to hold on when things, you know, when you can't see the end? Like, how is this going to turn out? And for a lot of trauma survivors, there is this panic when things feel out of control. Right? Because in the past, when things were out of your control, it went terribly wrong. So you don't want that to happen again. You can be in this anxiety or this panic, but that foundation of faith lets me know, you know, as it's been said, even when I'm not sure what the next steps are, I just believe in the end it's going to work out for my good. I just believe it. So that allows me, and it doesn't, it's not convincing me that every moment or every day is going to be sunshine, but I believe it's not permanent, that when I'm in a pit, it's not permanent.
I wonder whether you've been drawing on that this year.
Oh, my goodness. It has, and the timeline keeps changing, right? I remember when the pandemic started and one of my clients kept kind of setting herself up for disappointment because she would say, like, in 2 months, I think we'll be out. You know, and it was like by the third time she did that, it was, you know, just too much. So I said, you know, let's release the trying to predict it. because sometimes, you know, setting those goals can help us if that's really going to happen. But when that's not happening, sometimes we have to like really, and this is something many of us do, I think all of us do, is we created these false timelines for the way our lives are supposed to be. I, you know, laugh when I think about as a kid, I would say, you know, when I'm 21, I'll graduate from college. When I'm 22, I'll get married. When I'm 23, I'm going to have twins. I had my twins' names. You know, we have it all laid out. And it's like, that's not what happened. So it is an exercise in releasing our grip on the illusion, because we never really were controlling it all anyway.
I'm thinking of the friends who scheduled weddings and then rescheduled weddings and then rescheduled weddings.
Right? It's hard when we can't predict and control. And that's been the message that many of us have gotten, is be organized, set deadlines, work hard, and you can control your life. And this has been a lesson. And some things are out of your control. Doesn't mean anything about you being a good person. Doesn't mean God is mad at you. You know, doesn't mean you failed. It means it's different from what you pictured.
When you or your family are diagnosed with cancer, you want the best and most advanced care. At Mount Sinai's Cancer Centers of Excellence, multidisciplinary experts from oncologists to researchers create a team dedicated to you. They develop advanced diagnostic and treatment options while giving compassionate care in a welcoming environment. Learn more about Mount Sinai Tisch Cancer Center at mountsinai.org/cancer. We find a way. Mount Sinai.
The past year has also been a time when lots of people have been thinking about racial trauma and healing, which is an area of expertise for you. I'm wondering whether the past year has sharpened or changed your thinking and how your experience in this area has shaped how you've seen the events of the past year.
So many of us have been doing this work for a long time. And so it was startling when so many people were able to see the alarm we have been ringing for years, right? So in 2006, I wrote a therapeutic framework for addressing racial trauma. But when everything happened this past year, suddenly psychologists were saying, I think we need some kind of framework. I think like somebody needs to look at this. And we're looking like, well, the framework is there. Like we've already done this. So it was like disorienting a little when, it's like for people who are passionate about the environment and then suddenly people are on board and it's like, oh, like what? So y'all are ready? Like I've been ready, but you're ready. So it has been a really busy year and a half where so many people, organizations, because at first a lot of organizations and corporations and institutions of higher learning were like posting statements. And rightfully so, many of their students or employees said, we don't just want a statement. What are you going to do? And so it's been a very busy time for those of us who do consulting work in this area to come in and like facilitate a process, you know, a learning process, a community building process around equity. And so even though at first we were like, oh, this is like a divine time for us all to be still in our homes. But then when people figured out these virtual meetings, it was like kind of nonstop meetings. And I'll say for me personally, this push and pull between, I'll say to be frank, to be explicit, educating white people or taking care of members of my own community. You know, people in the Black community and an Asian community, Latino community, American Indian have been really traumatized. And so, you know, there is one of me. And of course, one of the things I had to do during this year was start referring people because there just are more people who know my name, but I know other people who do great work who just aren't as known. But, you know, trying to decide in the limited time I have, like this week or this month, am I going to go do this series for this all white organization about what is racism? Or am I going to do this series in my community with people who are grieving and angry and feeling loss of hope, right? So you had those pulls. And then I'm a faculty member at an institution. So then, of course, my own home institution, you know, was wanting a lot. My faith community was wanting a lot. And then, you know, I started with this whole thing of radical self-care, right? Like I am not only an instrument or a vehicle or a tool, right? I am a person who is feeling a lot of these feelings. And so, you know, having to, it became like a choreography, a dance between pouring and finding ways to rest and receive, learning when to set boundaries and then when to re-engage. And that continues to be a challenge.
What you're talking about is kind of just really resonating and hitting home in a sense, because I feel like this has been such a major milestone of a year in so many ways, but there's also, in a sense, this sort of, I don't know what the proper term is, but like Black fatigue of like always having to be that person to represent these messages and to teach like what's appropriate and what's the conversation that needs to be had. And so much is put on Black employees. It's a little bittersweet. It's like we've been waiting for this moment and I'm glad we're having these conversations, but then so much is put on specific individuals, and especially what you're talking about. I can only imagine how much you've been tapped for these types of conversations. So sorry, it's not even really a question.
I appreciate it. To say yes. It's so true. And it's called a racial battle fatigue. You know, we actually have a name for it, of being in an environment, you know, where racism is so tangible. It is exhausting. And another piece people don't often recognize is the emotional labor, right? Because I have to, it's not just what do I know, you know, as every good teacher knows, it's like trying to figure out a way to articulate it in a way people can hear it and receive it and know that many times the defenses against it, you know, you feel the urgency of like, if you don't get this, like lives are at stake. If like, if you don't understand like why this is important, there are consequences. And so there is the urgency, the intensity, the emotional labor. And I will say, you know, from having done it for many years, what makes it a little easier for me is usually I can predict the pushback, right? Before, like when I'm talking, I already know like what people are going to say, like, but what about and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, then I'm like, okay, here we go. That's fine. Right? But yes, as you were saying, it can be draining. So figuring out ways to refill your well. And for some of us, the thing we used to do to refill was community. And then like, okay, now church is online, poetry's online, which it feels a little different.
It has me thinking a little bit like there's been so much just from an organizational perspective when it comes to racial trauma. But, you know, even on the day-to-day things, you know, the moments where someone just doesn't even realize or recognize what they said as racist. They have no idea that what they said is absolutely racist, and it just kind of hits you in your face. And having to, my question for you, because this is something that I've, you know, like yeah. most people have dealt with and are still dealing with, how do you bounce back from moments like that, that this this subtle
microaggressions?
Yes. How do you handle moving forward through that and not allow something like that to just totally blow up your day, your mood, yeah. your moment? Like what's kind of your...
Right. Yes. Thank you for that. A part of it is being a part of an affirming community. And that's why it is helpful, whether it is members of your own community or allies, it's important to have people in that environment who get it and see it, right? You know, I have worked in some places and it helped to just be able to catch eyes with somebody. Like, did you just see that? Right? Like, this is some foolishness. You know, when everybody around you is acting like nothing happened or like it's not a big deal, it, you know, it's gaslighting. It's very, but just to have someone, whether they are from the same community, same race or not, who validates it, who affirms that that was like out of order. If they, you know, affirm it to you in private after, that can be helpful. What can be even more helpful is when people are willing to say something. And that's, you know, what it really means to be an ally, is being willing to stand in the gap, being willing to take the discomfort for me not to feel like if I don't say something, no one will say something. And, you know, I'm one of those people that can have a delayed, I'm one of those like hours later where you're like, now what I should have said, right? So, and it used to like just always kill me growing up because I have a brother who's fast, right? If somebody says something, he's like, bam, bam, bam. And, you know, I'm just more kind of deliberative. But one of the gifts of, if it's your workplace or a friendship circle, even if I didn't address it in the moment, I can come back to it, right? So the next time we meet, you know, I want to say, I want to circle back to something that happened the last time we were here. So not to feel like, because I missed the moment, it's too late. So a part of that is empowering, having allies, having a support system, being able to address it, if not in the moment, in a follow-up experience, and then reminding yourself who you are. Because it's even more hurtful when we have what we call internalized racism or internalized oppression. If I feel like less, and then you tell me I'm less, like it's even more devastating. You know, if I feel like I am unattractive, and then, you know, they had an article in Psychology Today, actually, this is a number of years ago, of Black women being the most undesirable women, right? So, you know, this is supposed to like this established magazine. So if you see those things and you, you know, have already been taught that, it will sting even more. So trying to really get to a place of affirmation. And here's our word again, that radical acceptance of like, even if the world disagrees, I think we're amazing.
Yeah, no, I think that's really great advice. And I too am like that, where in the moment, I'm more than likely not going to think of what to say right then there, yeah. right then and there. But I so wish on so many different occasions that I could have gone back and really pushed yeah. that person. And so one example that is popping up in my mind is just because it's a little bit more recent. So I went to Napa, first time going to Napa, loved to drink wine, was really yeah. excited about this, right. like getting to experience wine in Napa. It was just like, oh, this is great. And I went with my husband and another couple, and we just got to Napa, get out of the car, we check in at the hotel. It's this really nice hotel, and we go to get into the elevator. And there's this white middle-aged woman on the elevator, and I'm walking around the corner and she sees me, just me, because everyone else was further away. And she kind of was like, oh, no, like, don't get on the elevator. And my first initial thought was, oh, mm-hmm. COVID. I don't know why I thought it was like COVID. Oh, COVID, yeah. And then she was like, oh, it's fine. Like she like, it was really confusing. And I was like, okay, well, then we walked into the elevator. And so it's me, my husband, who's also Black, and then two others who, that the couple that we're with were all Black. We're sitting there in the elevator and she's looking at us and you can kind of tell she's had a drink or two. She's a little, you know, and she just goes, oh, how did you get here? Mm. And I looked at her and I said, what are you saying? And she was like, you could tell she recognized in that moment, like, oh,
yeah,
that was, that was not a proper thing to say. And then she goes, immediately turns it around and says, oh no, good for you. Mm. Good for you. For you guys are staying here. Good for you. And it was just so like, it happened so fast. And there's so many things you want to say in the moment because we all recognize immediately what it was. And you, like, I believe the couple even like gasped, like the couple that I was with, it's like, like, you're just like caught off guard and it's so subtle. And I think she thought she was being nice, which but here's so insane.
The thing
about
is,
the
your
thing.
Strategy was actually one of the recommended strategies to ask a person back, right? Because even you didn't have to say a lot, but just by you asking the question, it made her see herself. Yeah. Yeah.
She saw herself in
That's
that moment.
Beautiful.
She did. And she kind of panicked.
Yeah. So she had to chew on that.
She panicked.
And sometimes, if people are absolutely clueless, you ask the question and they still don't get it. But in moments like that, people who have some insight, they will say like, uh-oh, right? They'll try to backpedal or figure it out.
Yes. Like, oh, wait, that was bad. Like, and I want people to recognize this part of racial trauma, racial issues is even in these little moments. It's like we've been dealing with so many big things, but these microaggressions, these micro moments that people are still happening on a regular basis.
It is important for people to know and around, you know, want us to know, even though we use the term microaggressions, they can have a macro impact because it's cumulative. So sometimes people will say, oh, it was just a question in an elevator. But this question is not occurring in isolation, and it's not the only event. So it's event after event after event that builds up. And important for people to know, intention does not equal impact. So when some people say, well, I didn't mean any harm, it doesn't mean that it didn't hurt, right? And so for us to be able to lean into the discomfort instead of avoiding it. Because we have this whole thing now where people are like, it's too much cancel culture. And, you know, you just stop calling people out. But we have to understand accountability. And when people give you feedback or information that something is hurtful, offensive, racist, it actually is doing you a favor. They could not tell you. And you just keep walking around doing these harmful things. So for us to get to that place of humility of even if, like, I didn't know it was wrong or bad. And I grew up in a house where people said that all the time, or, you know, all of these things. Or I went through 12 years of school and never knew of one Black inventor. Or I didn't know that you all had contributed anything to society. Right. So now you're, you know, as an adult, you have to take responsibility for educating yourself, because the miseducation has promoted racism, make you think that the only people who have made this country great are white people, and it's just a lie. And so, yeah, the unlearning and learning can be really uncomfortable, but the only way to it is through it. Yeah.
What do you say to organizations to establish a culture where that sort of exchange can happen on a regular basis?
So it really starts with the leadership, because often it is put on the backs of employees of color, and often it is put on them for free. Like, this is a whole, it's a field, right? Just being born, this doesn't make you a facilitator of racial equity conversations. And so often the additional labor is put on people, and even the leadership has not really bought into it. So it requires, you know, a long-term commitment and investment of not just like we're going to say something once, you know, or issue this statement, but this ongoing dialogue. and the leadership can model an atmosphere of learning and humility instead of defensiveness. And the other piece I would say about that is we want to be careful about who is allowed to have feelings and what feelings are acceptable. So one of the things, you know, that people have written about is this whole piece of fragility. Specifically, we talk about white fragility, which is when if people of color are sharing their pain, if that moment is taken from them because white people are saying, I feel uncomfortable. And now white people are crying because I shared my pain. And then all the attention goes to the white person who feels uncomfortable about me sharing my pain. All right, so we can see how we totally missed it. It's like, you know, if you have a survivor of another trauma sharing what hurt them, but because they're upset as they're languaging it, us forgetting about their narrative and going to people's discomfort, right? So to say people who have been traumatized or stressed out by oppression may have anger, may have resentment, may have disappointment, may have grief, may have sadness about it. And that is understandable. You know, so I say as a psychologist, it's healthy to be outraged about outrageous things. It's just, what do I do with that, right? As opposed to pathologizing or problematizing someone who is upset. You know, so, you know, what people have said as it relates to the protests is some people were more angry that we're protesting than the deaths we're protesting about. So we want to work on our own emotional capacity to hear and sit with other people's pain without trying to force them to dilute it, to censor it, or to take care of us.
Thank you so, so much, Dr. Tema, for your brilliance, for your expertise, for your warmth, and for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Tema Bryant-Davis is a minister, an artist, and a professor of psychology at Pepperdine University. That's all for this episode. As always, if you enjoyed it, head over to Apple Podcasts, leave us 5 stars and a nice review. Thank you. For more resilience tips, including transcripts and photos, visit our website, mountsinai.org/RTR, as in Road to Resilience. The podcast is a production of the Mount Sinai Health System in New York City. It's made by me, John Earl, Nikki Cheatham, Emma Stoneham, and our executive producer, Lucia Lee. From all of us here, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.